Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Wednesday, the 6th of April. And joining me on this edition, our assistant editor, Steve Withers.
Yes, like when I was 17, my sister wanted to loan my Def Leppard record and I said, no way.
News editor, Mark Hodgkinson.
Excuse me, a baking powder.
And welcome back to the final Wednesday podcast. If you are one of these people who'd have to download it straight away on a Wednesday, you will notice from next week, the 11th, you'll be able to download it from the Monday. So you get it 2 days early. There you go.
Once you get it 2 days early. After that, it's every other week.
Yeah,
it's every week.
Yeah, but then it's a Monday, so they've got all week to listen to it, haven't they? So competition time, anything to win?
Currently, no.
And Mark, previous competition winner?
Yes, there is. There's this week. So a copy of The Warriors on Blu-ray is going to Pit Stop Guido. I think that's pronounced.
Okay. Good stuff, and there might be competitions up by the time this podcast goes live. There just isn't anything at the moment. Moving on, let's go to hardware news, and we talked about it last week briefly. Steve, you had a bit longer to play about with it now, but the UBD K8500 from Samsung, the Ultra HD Blu-ray player, is going to be released when, and it's going to cost how much?
It's going to be released on the 18th of April, so that's 2 weeks as of this podcast recording, and it will cost you £425. I should point out that's the recommended retail price. It may be different. That may be slightly cheaper than that, depending on dealers and stores and things like that. But the recommended retail price is £429, which is probably a bit more than we were expecting. I think everyone was kind of expecting a £399 price point.
However, for a new bit of kit, for a new technology, for a new format that's launching, that is not too bad, actually, price-wise, when you look at, well, when we go back to Blu-ray when it first came out. First player was £1,000 for that.
Yeah, exactly. People have short memories when it comes to that kind of
HD
thing.
HD DVD, although it got cheap pretty quickly, I'm sure the first player was around about the £400 mark as well, the big Toshiba A1, because I remember buying that from the States. So, in terms of pricing, it's not as bad as we feared.
No, I mean, I think there seems to be a mentality these days that everything should be cheap all the time. You know, but I think if you're talking about cutting edge new tech, a £429 price tag for a brand new Ultra, the first Ultra HD Blu-ray player on the market, that seems pretty good to me. And certainly it's comparable to historic prices, if not better than the majority of the, you know, the first players of other things like DVD, like Blu-ray, like HD DVD. And yes, people always go to do the thing about, well, it's $399 in the States. But the States is a different market. First of all, it's five times bigger than our market. And secondly, they use US dollars. That's the world's reserve currency. So Korea, a Korean company like Samsung doesn't have the same kind of exposure in US dollars as it does in sterling. So first of all, it's already going to have hedged its sterling exposures with exchange rates that are probably nothing like the current exchange rate. So we don't know exactly what they've hedged their exposures at. Plus, you've got the US price won't include state taxes. Okay, remember that. Secondly, if you can, if you can import that player into the UK after adding in VAT, import duty, shipping costs, and the extortionate exchange rate that your credit card company is going to hit you with from buying it in the States, and then go and buy a power adapter because it's going to be 110 volts. And don't forget, it'll only play Region A Blu-rays for normal Blu-rays, not for 4K Blu-rays, but for normal Blu-rays. If you can get that in for less than $399, well done, go for it. But, you know, it's never apples against apples with this kind of stuff, and people need to remember that, and I think they often forget.
Bit of a rant there, Steve.
Because I get weird about it every time, but they just don't understand the basics of, you know, international economics.
The way I look at it, four times the cost of a conventional Blu-ray, you're getting four times the resolution.
Excellent. They should put that in the advertising.
Yeah, you can tell who the ex-banker is here, can't we? Anyway, so you've had a bit longer to play with it.
Yeah, I mean, if I had two criticisms of it, I do personally miss there not being an actual display on the front, although my friend who saw it said that was a good thing because he always just turns them off anyway because they're annoying and distracting. So, you know, I guess there are two views there. That aside, the build quality isn't fantastic. It's fine when it's in operation. You don't really hear it playing, but when the tray comes out, it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit noisy and it's a little bit light and... it is made of metal, but it's very thin metal. And I've got to mention last week, the remote control is a little tiny plastic thing. It's a bit crap too. But I've just programmed that into my Harmony One, so it doesn't make any difference to me. But yeah, the remote control that comes with it is underwhelming, to say the least.
So you've had it 2 weeks and that's all you've got to say about it?
Right. It works. HDR looks great. It's played all the discs that I bought. You know, I mean, it's essentially a Blu-ray player, but it plays HDR and 4K. It's... What's I don't know what else there is to say about it, really. What's the upscaling like? Mm. Oh, I haven't actually played any anything like a DVD in it or something like that. It does upscale. I was watching Game of Thrones last night using that player. So that was a regular Blu-ray. And I thought it looked excellent. So it was outputting 4K to the TV. So it was scaling that, and it looked really good.
Has it got any fancy processing options?
No. Actually, it's pleasingly simple in that sense. It's not loaded up with unnecessary processing and features you're never going to use or things that would affect the picture quality. So in that sense, it's relatively straightforward. It's a pretty basic, if you've seen any of the most recent Samsung Blu-ray players, the menu system is essentially the same other than a few minor differences, but it's nothing, it's not complicated or unnecessary in terms of its features. And I think that's a good thing, actually. I mean, they've kept it pretty much, it's pretty simple. Out at the back, there are two HDMI outputs, so one for the picture and one for the sound if you don't have a receiver that can pass HDMI 2.0A. And there's an optical digital output and an Ethernet port, although it's obviously got built-in Wi-Fi.
Is that the only way you can use HDMI 2? Is it just audio only, or will it also, can you stream it out onto two displays?
No, the second one is audio only.
Right.
Which is a bit annoying, actually, because that would be quite a handy way of testing two TVs at the same time.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, it's only audio for the second HDMI output.
Has it got streaming services? 4K?
Yes, it has. Well, it has the three main ones at the moment, Amazon, Netflix, and YouTube. So in a sense, it's...
But Steve, can you use them?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a fairly moot point in my particular case, but assuming you have a fast enough internet connection, yes, you can.
Sorry, I couldn't resist that.
No, it's, it's what it is. It's a very, very competent Ultra HD Blu-ray player. It does the job. It's not too flashy. It's designed to hit a specific price point, and it works. Other than that, I'm not quite sure what else you can say about it, really.
Okay, so we'll look.
Let's put it that way.
we'll look forward to your in-depth and 10,000-word review. So that review should be coming up in the next, next week anyway. We've got some things to go and see and things to go and do this week as well. So, Steve has. The rest of us are not having to leave the house or do anything strenuous, Mark, are we? But Steve, you're off to London tomorrow?
I am, yes. We're recording this on a Monday, so I'm off to London tomorrow on the Tuesday to see LG to get a look at their new OLED TV lineup, which I think will be quite exciting, because we saw the E6 and the G6 at CES, but we haven't seen the C or B. So hopefully they'll be available to look at, and we'll get a full lowdown on what they're doing with OLED this year, release dates, prices, etc. Hopefully, so should be very interesting, because LG have been suspiciously quiet of late, I think.
Okay, and on Friday you are UHD Blu-ray in it again.
Yes, I'm off to see Panasonic to talk to their the UHD Blu-ray player team from Japan are over for some one-on-one sessions to talk about the player. And hopefully, again, we'll get more info on the player and release date and price.
So this week, we thought, as it is the last podcast on a Wednesday, we'd have a bit of a special interview session. And this time, because we've been talking so much about UHD Blu-ray and HDR and all the new formats and will this work and won't this work and how do we calibrate and all the rest of it, so from Spectracal, we got Tyler and Joel. But before we go ahead, this is a little bit on the techie side, or certainly it gets that way in the interview, and there's no way we can get around that because it is a technical subject at the end of the day, and there's a lot to try and understand, and this is the whole reason why we've got Spectracal on here, to try and answer some of the questions that certainly we have, and obviously in terms of the reviews that we're doing, we're still experimenting, we're still checking what the best way is to measure things and so on. So there are a couple of points which are probably going to get raised in the interview that we think, before we do that, we'll give you a bit of a glossary, which should help things in terms of understanding exactly what we're talking about. So I guess the best thing to do, first of all, is the one that's going to stick out for everybody is triplets. And we're not talking about
three identical
kids or whatever. What are triplets, Steve?
RGB triplets, it actually sounds more complicated than it actually is, as I'm sure the listeners are aware. In video terms, you add together the three primary colours of red, green and blue to create your image. If you add equal amounts of red, green and blue, you'll end up with white. And you adjust the amounts and you can create all the colours within the visible spectrum. RGB triplets just refers to those three primary colours and then their numerical number in terms of video. So It's between 0 and 255. So you'd have red between 0 and 255, green between 0 and 255, and blue between 0 and 255. So clearly, if you had 0 red, 0 green, 0 blue, that's absolute black. If you had red 255, green 255, and blue 255, then you're talking about peak white. And then if you had equal amounts
that's
of those...
That's 8-bit, though, isn't it, Steve?
In 8-bit, yeah. And so if you have equal amounts of, so say, for example, 50 of red and 50 of green and 50 of blue, then you're talking about, you know, a shade of grey at 50. And that's all it basically is. So it sounds more complicated than it is, but it's just adjusting these numbers to the amounts of red, green, and blue effectively within the image to create different colours. And obviously the coordinates that are used for things like Rec 2020 or Rec 709 or DCI, those use amounts, you know, of these triplets, so numbers for red, green, and blue, specific targets. That's basically what an RGB triplet is.
Okay. Mark, EOTF.
Electrical optical transfer function. Well, in terms of the HDR content, they use the PQ, which we struggled with to say last week, which is a perceptual quantizer, which it mirrors more the function of the human eye and how it translates the digital information into light. So there's more emphasis placed on the darker part of the spectrum. And listening to the interview, because I wasn't involved, it's also more efficient, isn't it, than using a power gamma law. So there's less bits involved to get from black to white, as it were. It's a more efficient use of bits. Yeah, so it's just a different way of creating the light effect from the old gamma curve.
Phil, as our resident photographer, would you like to quickly explain when they talk about stops on a camera, what exactly they mean by that?
No, because it's really difficult. you will see some camera manufacturers that say they have about 14 or 15 stops of light, which is not true. I mean, that's marketing. Easiest way to describe it. Think of gradations. So think of steps in the light on a ramp, a grayscale ramp, something like that. And think of each stop as, or each block as a stop. And that's roughly, it's about the dynamic range of the camera. I think that's the easiest way to explain it without getting really technical. So the more stops, technically the more dynamic range. But when they're talking about 14, 15 stops, I don't know any camera that does that. Like I say, you know, if it hit 12 stops, it'd be really superb in terms of dynamic range. And that's roughly where you are. So in terms of how HDR works, the intention is to try and cover that dynamic range and be able to show that dynamic range or as much of that back.
And that's what they're trying to achieve with these new standards, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically, I mean, in the past, using 35mm and so on, even 8 years ago, there's a certain dynamic range that was captured or was capable of being captured, and that's always been the case. The problem has been when it comes to presentation, because you're normally, if you're talking about film, you're normally a few generations down the line. And then when you're talking about transferring that to video, again, we've just discussed it there, you know, the number of bits that you have available, the amount of space that you have available to fit all that information in and get a colour image back. You're throwing away so much of the original content to be able to show it. That's why we have Rec 709, which is nowhere near as wide as DCI. And the reason we've had Rec 709 up to now is just because it was a solution to a problem. And that problem has now been removed by the new digital displays and, you know, the capabilities of displays nowadays. So we should now be able to look at something from the mastering point of view and be able to see that at home with the same colour gamut, the same dynamic range and so on. That's the intention. It'll take a few years to get to exactly that point, but that's where things are.
I think you'll probably also in this interview hear a couple of other things being mentioned. One was BT 1886, which is a standard that was only relatively recently agreed upon, which is actually is a gamma curve that's meant to represent the curve for a CRT, old CRT TV, which is, it's funny, they only recently agreed on that when they've been using that standard effectively for a long time, for decades and decades.
The issue was that when it came to the colour grade and putting the final, you know, material together, different studios were using different gamma PowerPoints. So some studios were using 2.2, some were using 2.4. Pixar were using 2.6. So 1886 was a way of trying to standardise that. So, you know, the steps in production to try and make sure everything was the same, no matter what studio it was and so on. And so 70-20-84 is yet another way of saying to the graders and, you know, the way that colorists and so on are finishing this, that is the gamma that they will use when doing the HDR versions, and that will translate through metadata to your display. So anyway, I think it's time for the interview, so we'll have a quick ident and we'll come back with our interview. So joining us on the podcast now is Tyler and Joe from Spectracal. Good afternoon, guys. Welcome along to the podcast. Maybe you could start by introducing yourselves, and maybe we'll go to Tyler first, and you can tell us what job you do at Spectracal, and then we'll move on to Joe, and then we can get into the nitty-gritty of what we're going to talk about this afternoon.
Hello, I'm Tyler Pruitt. I'm Spectracal's technical liaison. My responsibilities are for working with customers and bringing their suggestions to the engineering team and vice versa. Also, I'm responsible for the on-site training and workflow development.
Hi, I'm Joel Barsotti. I'm a head of advanced color research and the lead developer for Calman.
Well, like I say, welcome to the podcast, guys. And we're going to talk about HDR to start with, because I think in terms of AV, in terms of what our listeners are interested in terms of new TV technology and so on, it's the big buzzword at the moment. It seems to have overtaken, you know, 4K resolution as the big subject matter. But at the same time, there's a lot of misinformation out there about what HDR is. So from your point of view, what exactly is high dynamic range?
Well, high dynamic range for me is mostly about being able to make more intense, colorful images. And, you know, a lot of it, people talk about brighter and, you know, 1,000 nits and 10,000 nits. And, you know, that is sort of, you know, functionally how it works, but it's really a means to the end, with the end goal being able to, you know, produce images that have color that, you know, we haven't really been able to reproduce, you know, with conventional technology to this point.
So with the normal consumer TVs that people are used to, HD TVs and so on, what we're talking about here is that the color that they've always seen on their TV, if it's set up correctly, is what we would call Rec 709, which was the color profile for HD and PAL TV in the UK. And what we're talking about with HDR is not only brightness, but also a wider color. So what we mean is they're a far more colorful image. Is that correct?
Well, that's part of it. But more what I'm thinking of is just how, you know, when you start talking about light and stops and how many stops of light, you know, cameras can capture and the human eye can see, what happens is that the brighter a color is, the more colorful it can be. And because we've had to sort of tone map and range compress everything we've captured onto consumer displays to be able to view video, we've never been able to really reproduce the actual colorfulness that the human eye can see when we've got, you know, a red that's, you know, 50 or 60 nits. And it's, so it doesn't have to be significantly brighter than SDR, but with HDR, because we can produce so much more light, we're also able to reproduce much brighter colors as well, which is one of the things that really makes HDR stand out. And of course, with the HDR implementations that we're seeing coming out, they are packaged with the wider color gamuts, which also enables them to produce much more saturated colors. But in some of the early implementations of HDR that I was able to see, they were still working in Rec 709, and the results were still really, really impressive. So it's not just the wider color gamut. It is primarily the ability to not have to do the range compressed tone mapping that we get currently when they take, you know, film or video and try to compress it down to fit into the SDR range that our current displays do.
Why do you think there is so much confusion about this subject?
Well, the reason there's so much confusion is because up until recently, there have been very few formalized standards, and the ITU is currently working on, you know, the Rec 709 equivalent of HDR. And so while we've got authoring standards for how to make HDR content, we don't have any guidelines for consumer reproduction, and You know, even though we're just now starting to see distribution, we've got a Blu-ray spec for how to take that stuff that we've authored and then put it onto a disc to distribute it. We still really don't have a good standard for how to take that content and reproduce it, and trying to preserve the intent that was used to create the content.
Yeah, so everybody talks about metadata, but there's no guidelines on how you're supposed to use that metadata to remap the luminance and the color volume. So every TV manufacturer is kind of rolling their own thing and coming up with their own ideas on how that should work. And based on the measurements we've taken on some displays, they're doing things differently. So until there's a standard on how you're supposed to treat the metadata and what is the proper way to roll off the highlights, what is the proper way to reduce the color volume from the mastering display to the consumer TV, the reproductions are kind of going to be all over the place. So hopefully that happens soon.
Are there currently efforts being made to create some kind of standard?
Exactly. Yeah. So we're looking for the ability to have, you know, reproduction standards, because the general guidelines for packaging is that you describe your content as Rec 2020 color, so that, you know, whatever the, you know, color value you're encoding is using Rec 2020 RGB primaries to come up with your RGB triplets. The PQ gamma curve is, or EOTF is, the designated EOTF for HDR, at least for the Blu-ray spec. And then, you know, you take those and then you can figure out how to put the bits in onto the disc, and then you get the metadata for what the display that was mastering it was actually capable of. And so, you know, with those different guidelines, it works very much like conventional TV. And, you know, one of the reasons why it might be a little bit confusing is that the PQ EOTF turns a little bit of conventional calibration and display adjustment on its head, where all of the previous standards have all been relative, where a 0% signal should be zero, and 100% signal produces 100% of the display's light output. With PQ, it's an absolute bit level scale. So zero still should produce, you know, 0% signal should produce zero light, but 100% signal should always produce 10,000 nits, or the maximum that the display can produce. And so then the way the curve works, about a 50% signal is about 100 nit light output. And so, you know, on every display, a 50% signal should produce 100 nit output. And then as the display becomes more capable, perhaps it continues up the curve to whatever the display is capable of. So 600 nits, 1,000 nits, 4,000 nits. And whenever it reaches its peak luminance, it reproduces accurately up through that and then clips. And that's the way they set it up for mastering displays, where they're creating content, and so they're making all of the creative decision based on the capabilities of the display. And so that feeds back into, you know, Tyler's comments about, you know, how do we figure out how to roll these off? Because if your consumer display only does 800 nits, well, then there's, you know, 200 code values in 10-bit land that are above the capability of your display that you don't want to throw that data away. You need to figure out a way to map that onto the current display. And so that whole transition from a relative EOTF to an absolute EOTF is probably one of the bigger issues that people have to wrap their head around when moving from SDR to HDR.
You've mentioned a lot of things there, and I think we have to break them down bit by bit just so people don't get confused. But do you want me to start off? Because one of the other big issues that people have got is there's more than one type of HDR. So do you want to quickly just explain the differences between the two main ones, which are HDR10 and Dolby Vision?
Well, HDR10, I would actually say HDR10 and Dolby Vision are actually incredibly similar. The one that's really different is HLG, which is from the BBC and the NHK. And those are really the only two kinds of HDR. There's Dolby Vision and HDR10, which are both built around the PQ EOTF, and then there's the BBC NHK that is built around the hybrid log gamma formula for the EOTF. Because basically, with HDR, the biggest differentiator between, you know, wide gamut Rec 2020 SDR is the EOTF. And so Dolby Vision and HDR10 are are really very similar. The biggest difference between the two of them is simply that Dolby Vision uses a dynamic metadata structure, and the fact that it's a closed ecosystem means that they do in fact have gamut remapping targets, and it's a fully sorted end-to-end process, but it's a closed system that requires licensing. But both of the standards both use the PQ-EOTF. HDR10 uses static metadata, so there's one set of metadata for how the content was mastered on the display, and that's used for the entire program. And then with Dolby Vision, it goes scene by scene. And so if on a particular scene it didn't get very bright or didn't use very much wide gamut color, they're able to take that information and burn it in on a frame-by-frame basis so that displays can be more intelligent about when they do their remapping and how they do their remapping.
And as you get further away, as the TV is further away from the master display, so as the HDR displays or the HDR functionality gets pushed down to lower and lower models, the metadata becomes even more important. Because if you're within like 100 nits of the mastering display and your color volume is almost the same, you really hardly have to do any remapping at all. But say you have like an edge lit display that only does 500 nits, then you got to do a lot of remapping. And especially if its color volume or its color space is just barely over Rec. 709. So that's where the dynamic metadata becomes more important. But one thing we should also mention is there's a pending submission of dynamic metadata for HDR10. It's a SMPTE 2096, but it's unclear right now if existing TVs will be able to be upgraded to that, or whether that will be put into Ultra HD Blu-ray, or how that's actually going to roll back into HDR10. It's not clear right now how that's going
to
work.
I think just listening to this conversation, I mean, I think you need to be at a certain technical level just to try and keep up with what is being explained here, because there's a lot of terminology, a lot of acronyms, and I guess this is where, you know, the enthusiast gets mixed up. This is where misinformation comes in, because there's so much going on. There's so many different levels of things. And Tyler, I think you hit the nail on the head there talking about the remapping. I mean, a lot of that is going to make or break how HDR looks for the end consumer on the display and source that they're going to have.
And it also affects calibration, because with Dolby Vision, we've worked closely with them to get the color volume of the individual displays as targets in CalMan to calibrate to, which maps up with Dolby's tone mapping technology. So we have a specific targets to hit. With HDR10, every display has a different color gamut and luminance, peak luminance. And so far, nobody's provided what those are. So you don't really have a target to calibrate to. You can calibrate the EOTF until it starts to roll off. You can calibrate it to D65, which is the white point, but you don't know what the gamut is supposed to be, and you have no way to test if their tone mapper is working correctly. So that's one kind of problem we have, is with HDR10, there's no targets to calibrate to when it comes to the gamut and the roll-off of the highlights.
Yeah, and just even to add into that, even if there was, say, a strong algorithm that was provided on how to do that, we would still be in a situation where we would need also a strong recommendation on pattern size to do that, because the different display technologies handle pattern sizes differently, because one of the main enabling technologies for HDR and flat panels is the zone backlighting systems. And so depending on the display, different window sizes light up different numbers of zones, which enables them to drive the zones harder. And so depending on the window size, you can get very different luminance values out of a display.
And I think we're kind of settling in on that, where the UHD Alliance and other people are recommending now a 10% area window. And that covers the capability of it allows OLED to do full brightness, and pretty much all the zone backlight LCDs to hit full brightness with a 10% size window. The different displays have different, they treat different window sizes differently. Like on OLED, I think you can get up to 25% area before it starts to not be able to do full luminance. I think on some of the zone back lighting systems, like on Samsung's JS9500, I think you can get to 40 or 50% area before the luminance rolls off, where you can't do a full screen white as bright as the window, just kind of the behavior we saw with plasma. But that's not always the case. The Vizio RS series actually can do a full screen brighter than a small window. They like really over-engineered the backlighting system, where it doesn't roll off with size. It actually can get brighter.
So, and that's a Dolby Vision TV, isn't it, as well?
Yes. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds as though, from what you said at the beginning of this conversation about there being a distinct lack of standards at the moment in terms of HDR, it looks as if Dolby, albeit in a proprietary format, is providing an end-to-end standard of their own. Would that be correct?
Yes.
And, well, they have, like, Dolby's the one that came up with the ST2484 or PQ curve, and then they said, everybody thought this was a great idea, so let's release that to SMPTE and make that an open standard. But they held back all their tone mapping and gamut mapping and dynamic metadata. So now they've also are going to release that, the dynamic metadata part, to SMPTE as ST2096, but they're still going to keep their proprietary tone mapping technology to Dolby Vision.
To put that into like a little anecdote, I was talking with one of the color scientists from a post house, and he basically summarized it like this. Dolby came up with a bunch of great ideas for HDR, and they wanted to license it out. And so they got together and basically gave away all of the ideas that are part of HDR that cause problems, and then we'll sell you the solutions to all of them.
I guess there's a couple of points raised there. I mean, you've been talking about, you know, full array backlight LED LCD TVs. What about edge lit TVs? Because the vast majority of the HDR TVs that are going to hit the market this year, especially in the UK, are going to be edge lit LCDs.
Yeah, and they're working on the ability to do it with an edge lit is there. I mean, they still have a, you know, can universally raise and lower the backlight on a scene by scene basis. It's just that, you know, with LCD, the IPS panels have, you know, 1,000 to 1 contrast, or maybe 1,500 to 1 on some of the very latest, greatest IPS panels. You know, the VA technology panels, I think, do 2,000 or 3,000. I might be underestimating that a little bit, but I don't, you know, there aren't really any LCD panels that do much more than that. And so, you know, that defines your, you know, your local contrast, where you can't get, you know, very much more than that. And so with a single backlight control, you know, you're not ever going to be able to produce wider dynamic range than that. Whereas with the zone lighting schemes, they're going to be able to, you know, have a flashlight in a corner and push that really hard if they've got tight controller, or an OLED is going to be able to do it even better. Where you've got, you know, a flashlight in a dark room kind of scene. And so with zone lits, they'll still be able to do that, but it'll have to be a bigger compromise where the black floor comes up a little bit more and the flashlight doesn't quite get as bright.
Have you done any testing with edge lit in terms of windows and how much performance you're getting from them and so on?
I measured a Sony 850C. It did around, if I remember correctly, around like 400 or 500 nits. But the person had it in a real theater. The black level wasn't as perfect as a full array set, but I thought the HDR looked good on it. A lot of people get hung up on like overall brightness, but you know, it depends on what kind of environment you have, and you're also still getting the benefit of the wide color gamut and the much brighter colors. So I think people are quick to dismiss the edge lit sets without actually seeing them, but I was actually pleasantly surprised on the performance of it.
And my comments weren't meant to say that edge-lit HDR is not going to work. It's just not going to look as good as the full ones. But, you know, would I take one over, you know, an old plasma? Oh, yeah, I probably would.
So you've mentioned it a couple of times. So just because there's a lot of jargon being mentioned and various things that I think people are finding confusing. So we've talked about HDR. You've mentioned it a couple of times, and that's the PQ gamma ST2084. Do you you want to just explain exactly what you mean by that?
Sure. SMPTE ST2084 is a standard for an EOTF, which is the electrical optical transfer function. An EOTF is the formula we use to take bits from digital video and turn them back into light. And so, you know, basically all of the content that we watch is all display referred content, meaning that whoever created the content was, you know, looking at a screen when they made the creative decision on how it should look, not looking at a camera and setting, you know, settings in a camera, or, you know, scene referred. It's all display referred light. And so, you know, the formulas that we use to go back and forth between, you know, the bits that we're going to put onto a disc and, or, you know, a stream or however we're storing the digital video and how that digital video should be displayed is a, the EOTF goes from the bits to the display, and an inverse EOTF takes whatever you see on a display and would convert that back into bits. And so SMPTE 2084 is, was based on research, by a scientist named Barton, who tried to sort of quantify how the human eye responds to light. And so, you know, people have always thrown around how, you know, gamma kind of mimics how the eye works. And, you know, we're really lucky that CRT is lined up with human vision because it's incredibly efficient. Well, this goes, you know, a level deeper and tried to really analyze where the human eye was most sensitive and try to align this transfer function with human vision so that the bits are as equally spaced to our perception of light as possible. And is with a, like the standard ones that we've been using where it's either a basic power curve or something slightly more complicated like BT1886, we kind of just barely have enough bits at the low end, or really don't have enough bits, certainly not in 8-bit, but just barely have enough bits maybe in 10-bit land, and then have, you know, too many bits at the high end where, you know, things then start blending really smoothly, but, you know, more smoothly than we need them to. And so SMPTE 2084 smooths that out so that it's as evenly distributing the bits along our human visual system as possible to make encoding video as efficient as possible so that they can cover the widest range of light possible. And so that's where the PQ comes in for, is that it stands for perceptual quantizer. So it's as perceptual as possible, taking the bits back and forth between light and digital signal.
And I wanted to throw something in there is, so when he means most efficient, it's, we want to go from 0 to 10,000 nits for HDR with as, without having to use as many bits. So if we would have used a gamma, a straight up gamma, like a 2.4 gamma, it would have took 15 bits to actually go to 10,000 nits without getting banding. With PQ, you can do it with 12 bits, and you can get up to 1,000 with 10 bits without getting any banding, unless the banding's in the source material.
Okay, great. So that's the SMPTE-ST2084 EOTF. And there's also a lot of confusion surrounding another aspect, which is REC 2020. Specifically, that there's obviously two REC 2020s here. There's REC 2020 that relates to the standard for Ultra HD, and there's also the REC 2020 color gamut. Do you want to just talk a little bit about how this actually relates to Ultra HD, 4K, and also HDR?
Sure. So REC 2020 came out as the UHD color gamut of choice, and then promptly proceeded to be irrelevant as the first UHD content that shipped was using REC 709 containers and signaling and encoding.
You're referring to like Netflix streams and stuff?
Yeah, Netflix. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Not the discs.
Not the discs, but the over-the-top 4K content. You know, when they started selling 4K TVs like 2 years ago, none of the 4K or UHD content was using REC 2020. But now that we're going to HDR and we're going, and we've got the UHD Blu-ray shipping, REC 2020 is here for real. And so REC 2020 gives you basically monochromatic laser primaries where they're basically 1 nanometer band spectral bandwidth signal. So, you know, in order, you know, right now the only thing that can do full REC 2020 are laser projectors. But it's the the reason that they decided to go with a scheme like this is it allows for growth. We can't do it right now, but we can see with emerging technologies like quantum dot and OLEDs that perhaps even with flat panels, we might be able to produce something that's very, very close to Rec 2020 over the next couple of years. And so the idea that they are deploying with the Blu-ray spec is in conjunction with the metadata for HDR, they're able to, you know, encode Rec 2020 content and then signal the metadata saying, well, but we weren't able to produce a gamut wider than this. And the idea is that, you know, a perfect Rec 2020 display that could do the full gamut could be ignorant of the metadata and would still produce the colors accurately. And then a display that is less capable can then read the metadata, and if it needs to, do a gamut compression to preserve intent as best it can. And, you know, or if both the, you know, if the mastering display was, you know, say roughly DCI-P3 primaries, and the display was capable of that or slightly more capable of that, but still not full Rec 2020, it could then know that its capabilities match the mastering display and therefore, you know, take a hands-off approach and just, you know, display the content accurately without having to do any gamut remapping.
Okay, so given that the majority of the TVs coming out this year will be at or very close to DCI-P3 in terms of their color gamut, native color gamut, and given that the content from Hollywood is, well, exclusively DCI-P3 currently, and that's, I'm assuming, what they're using on the Blu-rays, on the Ultra HD Blu-rays, what you want really is to map that content to the TV precisely, yes, because that's what it's capable of.
Correct. And so, you know, the idea there, though, and this is the thing that is, you know, some people get hung up on, is that the content itself is described as Rec 2020 on the disc. So, for instance, the green in DCI-P3 has, you know, as it's described as Rec 2020, has, you know, quite a bit of red in it and a little bit of blue in it. And so the DCI green, as it's encoded on the disc, is encoded that way, where it has a substantial amount of red and a little bit of blue in it, as opposed to a pure primary. And so when you're doing calibrations and things like that, if you're going to be working on, you know, the signal that you're sending, you'd want it to, you know, map it as Rec 2020 green, and that way you'll be lined up with the color decoders and the different control mechanisms in the video path by using a Rec 2020 signal and Rec 2020 colors.
You see, that seems to be completely counterintuitive to how we've done things in the past.
So I guess the easier way to explain it, or not an easier way, but a different way, is the displays, the mastering displays, they're all P3, and they can get to Rec 2020 in different ways. You can either turn on a Rec 2020 emulation mode in the monitor, where it will follow the Rec 2020 saturations until it clips out. Or what a lot of people are doing is they'll leave the display in P3 mode, and then they just do a transform from P3 to 2020 signaling afterwards before they do the encoding on the discs. But since P3, there's no consumer standard, it's not even a possibility to tell the TV this content is P3. It has to be Rec 2020, but the mastering display metadata can say, yes, it's Rec 2020, but it doesn't go out any further than P3. So it says follow Rec 2020 until you hit the edge of P3, and anything out there, you need to remap.
Okay, so basically what we're saying is that on an Ultra HD 4K Blu-ray, although the original source may have been P3, it's being mapped to the Rec 2020 color space.
Or is that right? I wouldn't say mapped. I would say it's encoded as.
Yeah. So it's described as. So, you know, that when you take the, you know, that triplet that has a little bit of blue and a little bit of green and a lot of red in it, or a little bit of blue, full green and a lot of red in it, and run it back through, you know, the matrices that they use to do the math to go back and forth between RGB values and, you know, the XY color values that we measure, then, you know, that triplet that is, you know, of mixed values is then describing that DCI P3 color. And so, you know, all of the colors are described as Rec 2020 colors as they're put onto the disc for distribution.
Okay, so the next obvious question then is, in terms of going forward for calibration, how does one approach calibrating a display, the color gamut of a display, correctly for HDR and 4K?
The thing you'll have to do is you'll have to, as opposed to, you know, in the past we always used, or we typically used, fully saturated colors to align the color management system. In the Rec 2020 world, you're going to want to use some partially saturated Rec 2020 values, or colors that are sort of near the edge of what the display is capable of, but they'll be partially saturated in comparison to what Rec 2020 is capable of. And then you'll try to align that with the target values so that the Rec 2020 decoding on the TV then becomes transparent and accurate.
That sounds logical, but a lot of that is depending on how well the TV performs and how well it's engineered, does it not?
Yes, but as long as they give us a good color management system that works in a predictable manner, it's also very achievable. So, the idea is that, you know, you start out with what, the display does, and then you do the grayscale calibration, and then you layer on top of that the CMS calibration, and then those create a uniform additive color space where everything works correctly. And then on top of that, the display management layer that manages the metadata is layered on top of that. And that, if we follow those steps, then the display mapping module has a nice linear additive predictive model to work with. And as long as it's got a correct algorithm and good reference data for what the display is capable of, then we should be able to get high quality, accurate HDR as well.
If we bring this all the way back to the start of the conversation where we were talking about how there are no standards, how things are very much up in the air, and how only Dolby Vision really has an end-to-end system. When we're talking about calibration there, and we're talking about, well, if we do this, then it should do that, it seems to me like we're relying on a lot of shoulds and ifs and maybes at the moment.
Yes. I wish I could soften it in some other way, but that's exactly where we are right now. And, you know, there are some standards that are, you know, in the pipe with, the ITU is working on an HDR spec, and there's the spec and then also an addendum to the spec. And the addendum has some additional information on things that they're looking for, at least in terms of the tone mapping. So hopefully we'll have that soon. Which, you know, once something like that is available, you know, we'll be building that into Calman as fast as we can so that, we give an idealized implementation to put out there, and then hopefully, you know, reviewers and we'll hold the manufacturer's feet to the fire over them trying to meet the reference implementation. And then from there, the manufacturers will hopefully improve their implementations, and we'll, you know, eventually, I see in a year or two, end up with something that makes this look like a little troublesome worry over something that we didn't really need to worry about too much. It's just that we're earlier in the process than I think anyone's ever seen consumer technology before. You know, we're kind of watching the sausage get made right now.
Yeah. I guess the obvious question then, and it's a bit of a personal question for you guys, but if it was your money in your pocket and you needed to go and buy a TV, would you be buying a TV at this moment in time?
I'd probably wait until seeing all the reviews from the 2016 models.
Yeah, I mean, with the 2016s just on the verge of coming out, I would probably wait until someone else bought one first so that I could kind of see how it all sorts out. I mean, there's certainly going to be some great TVs, I'm a huge computer enthusiast, and so there's always something new coming out 6 months from now. And so at some point you'll just have to, you know, bite the bullet and commit. And I think that with HDR, this is one of those things where this pattern will probably continue into the future, which is, you know, one of the things TV manufacturers really like about HDR, and is that, you know, going forward, you know, this year's TVs might not get the mapping quite right, but next year's TVs will get the mapping perfect. And then the next year's TVs are going to add some nits. And then, you know, 3 years from now, they're going to be adding more color gamut. And, you know, we've seen the stuff they're working on for prototype mastering displays, and they're already pushing the nits up, and they're already pushing the color gamut out. And so the way they wrote the HDR spec enabled them to add capability as they go without having to rewrite the spec. And so, you know, from here forward until we all have, you know, perfect 2020 10,000 nit displays on our walls, every couple of years there's going to be a good reason to get a new TV. And so, you know, if you're going to try and wait for the perfect thing, you're just going to keep waiting because there's going to be something cool coming out in 6 months. So it's probably going to be one of those things where, you know, let the dust settle for, you know, this year and then pick the one you like.
It kind of sounds like beta testing on the public, though, doesn't it, really? And it sounds like a perfect cause if you're a manufacturer that people are going to have to update their TVs every 2 or 3 years. I mean, that's obviously the cynical view that some people are going to have about any new technology that comes along. In terms of what we do for a living, so testing these TVs and so on, what are Carmen, or what does Carmen have up its sleeves for us in terms of testing and for our members in terms of calibrating this year?
Well, you know, right now we've got the Dolby Vision support already in, and we've been working with them to add in the ability to extend it so that the end user can load in the Dolby Vision golden reference files for different TVs. So as you know, the lineup of Dolby Vision TVs explode, we're not going to be the gating factor for having Calman add in the golden reference for each individual display. And then I touched on the ITU's HDR spec, and you know, we've looked over the preliminary, and as soon as you know we've got a final spec in our hand, hopefully we'll be able to roll up their idea of tone mapping for HDR10. We're also working on adding the HLG support, which we didn't really talk too much about during this podcast, but it, you know, it sounds like if we're going to start getting live sports and, you know, live news production, you know, any kind of HDR that's going to be, you know, real broadcast, it's likely going to be the HLG variety. And so we're adding in tools for HLG as well. You know, we're beefing up our, you know, our color checker portion of the product and our gamut saturation portion so that people can accurately calibrate their, you know, displays in Rec 2020 mode, even though they're not fully Rec 2020 capable. And so we're, you know, adding features to make that part of the process smoother. You know, we're, you know, trying to understand HDR10 as deeply as possible so that we can help smooth off all the rough edges for our users.
And currently, Calman supports HDR10 metadata in several different pattern generators, including quantum data 780 and 804, the Astro generators. That's more of like a high-end manufacturing tool. And we're also adding support for the Meridio pattern generator for HDR10. And that allows you to set your own metadata. We have some defaults in there. I think we're defaulting to 1,000 nits for the peak, P3 for the mastering display, and 0.05 or 0.05 nits as the minimum luminance. But all that's configurable. So when you get a display, you're able to feed it different metadata and see it, look at its behavior, and you'll be able to tell if the display is doing proper roll-off, because different discs have different metadata. In fact, all the Warner titles, they were mastered first for Dolby Vision on Dolby's 4000 nit display, and their Ultra HD Blu-rays, HDR10, the mastering display metadata says 4000 nit highlights. So whereas the Sony and Fox titles, I think, are set to 1,000 or 1,100 nits. So you want to make sure that the display sees that and is actually responding to it. Different discs have different metadata for the mastering display because there's different mastering monitors. There's the Dolby Pulsar that does 4,000 nits and P3. It's an LCD-based display. And then there's the Sony X300 OLED that does 1,000 nits, that does P3, but that's an OLED. So different studios and different titles are using different metadata. And the Warner discs, like Mad Max and the Lego Movie, they were mastered on the Pulsar because they were originally mastered for Dolby Vision. So their HDR10 discs the metadata says 4,000 nit peak brightness, whereas the Sony and Fox titles, I believe, say either 1,100 or 1,000 nits. So you want to be able to set your pattern generator to different sets of metadata to check the behavior. It's not so much you're going to be calibrated for different things, but you know, after you're done calibrating, you want to see how is its behavior. If I say that the master display was 2,000 nits or 4,000, you should see a different roll-off. And if you don't, then the display obviously isn't taking that into account correctly. And so in Cowman, you can set all the mastering display metadata for HDR10, and that's a good tool to see if the display is properly rolling off the highlights or properly adjusting the gamut. And we are working with as many pattern generator manufacturers as possible, because we don't want this to be just like you have to spend $5,000 to get a pattern generator that does this. So we're trying to work with everybody to add the HDR10 functionality. And also, so currently for Dolby Vision, the only way to generate the patterns is with a PC HDMI output. And we have it working with NVIDIA and Intel graphics cards. We haven't been able to get it working with ATI, but it can be a little bit hard to configure. So we're trying to work with pattern manufacturers and Dolby on getting a Dolby Vision pattern solution that doesn't require a PC.
Yeah, and that just goes to how Dolby manages their metadata, because they embed it in every frame. If you start flipping bits arbitrarily and you're off by just a bit, then the Dolby Vision signaling falls apart, and they're, you know, using a special way to encode the data to fit the 12 bits into conventional RGB streams.
Like you said, you know, towards the start of this conversation, I think, you know, the clouds will start to clear, and I think this will seem much more of a molehill than a mountain that it seems to be at the moment. And we get there, and we're going to have some excellent pictures to look at, because like you guys said as well, I mean, we've seen a lot of HDR demos, we've been in a lot of Technicolor last year, seen stuff, you know, we've seen stuff at CES, we've also had our first display through for review, and when you see it done and done properly, it's it takes the viewing experience on, doesn't it? It adds so much more to what you're watching, and the effect of telling a story, because you got more there to look at in terms of color and brightness. And the one that blew me away was the demo of the start of Man of Steel, with the explosions going off all around, and just the brightness from that. It wasn't eye-searingly bright, but it was bright enough to tell the story and to make you jump and to get you involved with what was happening on screen.
Yeah, and it's not that I've seen that scene probably like 50 times. That was one of the first HDR demo content we had in the office. But we compared it to the Blu-ray, and those explosions are like highly saturated fire color on the Dolby Vision version. But on the Blu-ray, they're just white flashes, and there's no real color in them. So that's another thing where we can make something bright and colorful at the same time, where we can make something, you know, bright, but we couldn't make it colorful and bright together with SDR.
Yeah, and I that was kind of what I opened up with at the beginning of the conversation, is that's what HDR really brings, is, you know, with the way tone mapping works with conventional SDR, you basically only got bright or colorful, and now we get bright and colorful, and it's really impressive. And like you were mentioning, it's you know, a tool that filmmakers can now use to tell the story, and it's, you know, not something they need to use on every scene, but it's a great tool for them to have in their toolbox to tell a story.
I mean, we've been getting quite technical with this conversation, because obviously, you know, that is, for a lot of our listeners, they want to know a little bit more on the technical side and so on. But for people listening who are maybe still a little bit confused and wondering, well, should I buy an HDR TV, and what, you know, is the disc player going to work with my HDR TV, and am I going to see this properly, or am I going to have nothing but problems? What advice, given the testing that you guys have done, because obviously in the States you're a little bit further ahead in terms of disc being released and disc players being available and so on. What kind of things have you seen from your testing, and is it going to be nice and simple for the average consumer out there, or maybe the novice enthusiast who just wants to go and see this and sample this technology? Is it going to be easy for them?
Well, I think the manufacturers learned a lot with the 2015 TVs, because certain models you have to turn on the UHD color setting manually. Some, the HDR mode, when it activates, it disables a lot of calibration controls. And I think they learned those lessons with all the 2015 TVs. So I think we're at a point now they know that they need to give us the calibration controls in HDR mode, and they need to properly detect what's happening from the player so they don't have to manually engage any settings or stuff like that. Because if you have an out-of-the-box experience that's bad, you know, that can turn off you, and then, you know, you might not recommend it to other people. So I think the manufacturers learned a lot with the 2015 TVs, and hopefully the 2016 models will kind of smooth out the bumps that we had with the first players and the first discs and EDID compatibility and detection and cabling issues and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's at the point right now where if you like living on the bleeding edge of technology, then do it because it's awesome. But if you like everything to work when you just plug it in and don't want to have to think about anything, you probably do want to wait till next year. And of course, everything will cost less next year too. You can certainly see the writing on the wall that by, you know, next year for sure, everything should be just plug and play ready.
Thank you very much, guys, for taking the time to come on the podcast and speak to us this afternoon. And I'm sure that our listeners, having listened to that, are going to have a whole list of follow-up questions and so on. So maybe, you know, a couple of months down the line, we'll revisit this subject and we'll give you some questions. And of course, by that point, we will all have seen a lot more of the 2016 lineup, and we'll have had disc players and discs and everything else to try out, and we'll have been calibrating displays, and I have no doubt finding new problems along the way, but maybe we could catch up in a few months and see where we are.
No, sure, that would be great.
Thanks.
So quickly, Steve, to wrap up this week's podcast, the last podcast on a Wednesday, do you think I've said that enough times now? What's coming up at the cinema?
Two releases. On Friday, we've got The Huntsman's Winter War, which is a prequel / sequel to Snow White and the Huntsman, although without Snow White. So basically, it's Chris Hemsworth and Jessica Chastain, Emily Blunt, and Charlize Theron. So quite a good cast. I saw a clip of it. They were all on, well, some of the cast were on Graham Norton on Friday, and I thought it looked rubbish, and I wasn't particularly a big fan of Snow White and the Huntsman either. So, but anyway, that's coming out on Friday. And also a film called Midnight Special, which stars Michael Shannon and Kirsten Dunst, and this does look quite interesting. It's about a father with a young boy with unusual powers, who I'm not quite sure. It may involve aliens, not quite sure. But he has to get the kid to a certain place, and it looks intriguing. I mean, they've deliberately kept the details of the plot quite vague, which is good. Kirsten Dunst
sounds like a few things that we've seen in the past.
Yeah,
doesn't it?
The director of it has made some interesting movies though, so I'm kind of curious to see it. And Michael Shannon's, I think, is an interesting actor. And, you know, it's got Adam Driver in it, who played Kylo Ren in Star Wars The Force Awakens. So it's got an interesting cast, Kirsten Dunst as well. Yeah, it looks like it might be an interesting kind of sci-fi / chase movie.
But it's not a TV program about a boy who had...
I'm sure there's been loads of those.
Yeah, but he had powers where you could see into the future and that kind of thing. And yeah, it seems really similar to quite a few. Another film that's popping out is Knowing, which was similar-ish. So
I quite enjoyed Knowing until the end.
Until you knew.
Then it was like, oh, until, come on.
Until you knew.
Oh, come on. Yeah. Like, there's certain films. We should do a piece at one point on films with the worst endings, because there have been some shockingly, you know, things where... people do an ending and you think, no, you just can't do that in the modern age. It's been used too many times before. The one where it was all a dream. That's just the biggest cop-out in screenwriting history, isn't it? Or It Was All Aliens.
Yeah.
Is the other one. So Midnight Special is something that does look quite interesting to me, and I might check it out at the weekend if I get a chance.
Okay. There's no Blu-rays, is there?
No, it's strange. It's I don't know if it's the Star Wars effect, because remember before Christmas when Star Wars came out on, I think it was the 18th of December, for about 2 weeks before that, there were no releases coming out. No one wanted to go anywhere near Star Wars. There were no big films coming out at all. And for some weird reason, because Star Wars is coming out on Blu-ray on the 18th of April, there's no big Blu-rays coming out either. It's gone very quiet on the Blu-ray front. No major releases, really. Or it could be they're all, yeah. Now, well, there's only about 6 Ultra HD Blu-rays coming out in the UK next week. But yes, good point, Mark. If Ultra HD Blu-ray is your thing, next week we start to see the first, I think they're mostly the 20th Century Fox discs that are being sold. I mean, you can obviously buy them from the States already, but 20th Century Fox discs are coming out in the UK next Monday. I think there's 6 of them initially. Pricing's about £16, so not too bad, actually. £16.99, I think it is.
Where are you looking? It's all £19.99.
Is it?
Yeah. I saw. If you go on Amazon, it's $19.99.
All right, sorry, $19.99. I still think it's quite reasonable for Ultra HD Blu-ray and the Blu-ray included.
Yeah, as if it was $16.99, I'd have been pulling that arm off.
Yes, so there's, I think they're mostly Fox films, so like Kingsman, Asian 47, that sort of stuff. But they start shipping next week, just in time for, basically you can get some discs in ready for the players arriving the following week, or the first player at least, Samsung.
Okay, well, bit of a rush there at the end, but we are back again on Monday the 11th. That's right, not a Wednesday, it's a Monday. And until then, my thanks to Steve Withers.
Let's do the Thelma and Louise ending.
And Mark Hodgkinson.
Stop it. You look like you've got something to say.
Are you saying stop it to?
Cat.
All right.
Obviously.
And Bob is
attacking the wires.
All right, okay. Of course, moving to a Friday recording means that everybody should be available.
Apart from this Friday.
apart from the first Friday where Ed's not around, but never mind. Anyway, don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can bookmark AV Forum's the latest reviews, news and video. And of course, give us 5 stars on iTunes. And it has to be 5 stars for this to work. And we'll read your name out. I'm Phil Hinton. Thanks very much for listening. And like I say, don't forget, we are back again on Monday the 11th of April.